Bernard, thank you for that introduction. I suppose it's fair to say that Bernard and I are on fellow journeyists en route to actually trying to sort out what's wrong with Britain's strategy, or indeed more generally about strategy. And what I'm going to do today is I'm going to talk a little bit about, or propose a hypothesis, which is that the UK in specifically, and that the West in general, has lost its capacity to think strategically and to act strategically. I'm going to approach that hypothesis by looking at a narrative of what's gone in the last 10 years and see how that has worked. I'll then take stock of where we are and look in particular at Afghanistan, which is an area of particular interest to me, having served there. And I'll look a little bit about UK's objectives in Afghanistan and what we might do differently to finish off with. My background, as Bernard said, is very much naval aviator. I was in carriers, flew in the Falklands War. But I did have the great fun of being a naval officer in Afghanistan. Those of you will recognise the geography of Afghanistan as such that there's not a huge amount of sea there. That led to some amusing times because Sheriff Cooper Coles, who was my ambassador at the time, got fed up with describing my title and explaining it to the Afghans, so he started to call me Brigadier General. That was fun. At one moment when I arrived with 207th Corps in Regional Centre West, I was introduced as Brigadier General on what I thought was a courtesy call for the Corps Commander. We sat down and that courtesy call turned out to be a tactical call. So he soon got outmapped and I thought to myself, shall I tell him that I'm a naval aviator and don't really know much about the detail of the tactics? And I thought to myself, it'd be a terrible thing to disappoint him. So we sat and over the period of about now, thought through the different company positions, brigade positions and so on. And at the end of it, I'm pleased to say that in Herat, Taliban has still not taken over the regional centre west. So naval aviators can do this stuff. Let me start, though, much more seriously on the narrative. And I want to take you back to 2001 and think about 9/11 and the move into Afghanistan. A move dominated, of course, by thinking about AQ, Al-Qaeda. And what was so interesting, I think, in those early days was the logic of the Taliban not releasing AQ. We sort of thought that was for reasons of alliance, but I wonder now, knowing the campaign as I do, the extent to which it was the fact that the Taliban are Pashtuns, Gilzai Pashtuns, and that the honour code of the Taliban or the Gilzai Pashtun is such that you do not give up your guests. Did we get that wrong in terms of our thinking? What I think we also probably got wrong was not to recognise that although there wasn't a civil war existentially, it was going on underneath. And so when we arrived, and when the US Special Forces arrived with significant air power, then that civil war reignited. And so what Rumsfeld took to see, I think, as a new form of warfare, was actually something rather different. And I think actually the conclusions that were taken that into Iraq were probably badly mistaken. I think it was a great neocon fallacy that these things would be easy. We then go to 2002. We've seemed to be successful. The British are there in Afghanistan. We seem to be successful. But then Iraq kicks off. I remember arriving in America. I was in charge of the police arm at the time and not sure whether this thing was going to happen or not. I went to the Top Gun school. I was talking about carriers with the chap who was in charge of the American carrier school. This would have been March or April of 2002. Just to get a sense of what was going on, I said, how many carrier groups do you work up a year? He said, well, about six or seven. And I said, how many have you got to do? He said, none. And I thought to myself, he's done them all. This is going to happen. So when I came back, I made sure the fleet arm was ready, because I could tell that this was going to happen. Phase four, though, was the key, and it's very interesting talking to a friend, a US Marine Corps colonel, who was working in the Pentagon at the time, and talking to him about phase four preparations, that preparations after the invasion. And he said, you know, we started doing all the phase four preparations. He said, I had a US Marine Corps colonel. We went in, and we went specifically to the German experience and what happened after the Second World War, and started to do and draw all those lessons. And then at a moment where we were just starting those preparations, we were told by the Secretary of Defense's office to stop. And how interesting, what would it have been like if the phase four preparations had been properly thought through? But Rumsfeld clearly had a view, and a snowflake came down, and so all those preparations that might have happened, the intelligence preparations, didn't happen. We move into Iraq. I was in the Fleet Arm at the time, but I arrived late 2004 to work for Mike Walker, General Mike Walker, who's the Chief Defence Staff. And I saw and worked for him for about 14 months and then took over with Jock Stewart. I think it's fair to say that when we arrived, it was a bit of a quagmire. Iraq was the key area and the key problem area, and I think we had started to take our eye, if we hadn't already done so, off the Afghanistan ball. And I think we're all culpable to a certain extent in that. I remembered visiting Kabul and talking to the British Army General, who was the deputy in the ISAF headquarters, and him saying about Afghanistan, I remember it almost to the day, him saying about Afghanistan, it's just like a bad day in Northern Ireland. And so off we went. The thinking was really all down in Iraq, in Basra. Basra, having started well, was starting to go badly.
I think we'll have to speak up a little bit.
Yeah, sorry. Basra, having started well, was starting to go badly. And I think then there was a key divergence, I think, in UK and US thinking. The Americans, we know, surged into Iraq. And for those of you who haven't read it, I thoroughly recommend a book called The Gamble. And it talks about how this thinking changed, the change of thinking. Rumsfeld is moved on. And Jack Keane, who was the vice chief of the general staff, had retired. Then actually gets American thinking changed. He recognizes that there is a defeat in prospect, that if they don't do something, and off they go. We, meanwhile, I think had changed. I think actually that around about halfway through my tenure, in fact, in about April, when the new Chief of Defence Staff arrived, I think it would be fair to say that we had taken a strategic view that actually we were in basically was what we would call the military a retreating contact in Basra, and the key was to get out. I think looking back, that was a mistake. Happy to take questions on that. But we essentially, as the Americans surged in, we started to draw down and turn our attention to Afghanistan. In Afghanistan, the whole mission at that stage was about, as far as I can see, the unification of the NATO mission. And we were thinking about how this NATO mission, which was north was NATO, south was an American coalition, how that thing would be unified. And I don't think we really thought enough, looking back, and I include myself in this, I don't think we really thought enough about what the move into the south would look like. And for those of you who know Afghanistan, the key issue is that actually the north is Northern Alliance, and as you move into the south, so Helmand, Kandahar, and these places, you're moving into the Pashtun south. I'm not a Scot, but for those of you who are Scots, it's a bit like moving north into Scotland. And Scots are damn good fighters, and actually if they don't like the look of you, then you'll get that sort of reaction. I wonder the extent to which we will look back at our move into Helmand in mid-2006 in the same way that we look back at the move into Northern Ireland and Bloody Sunday. That's not a criticism of the powers. What it is a criticism of is our analysis that allowed us to think this stuff through, because I don't think we did enough thinking. I remember talking to a very, very clever army officer who was working out in the States. I remember saying to him, James, what are we going to do when we go there? And we had a bit of a debate, and we said, do you think we should war game this? And we said, yeah, we should war game this, actually. Unfortunately, the war game wasn't something that my boss really wanted to do, and it wasn't what the PGHQ wanted to do. And I look back with some regret that we didn't push hard on that, because I think if we had war games, I think we might have learned a bit. But then we arrive in Afghanistan with a relatively well-found force. And for those of you who think that the force wasn't of the size that the military wanted, that's quite wrong. The military force was at the size that we wanted and at the size that we had designed. It was a force that was bigger than the interim options that were looked at, but certainly the size of the UK force that went into Helmand was what the military asked for at that stage. Meanwhile, what was happening in Iraq? Iraq, the Americans were starting to surge in, or certainly they surged in. Late 2007, early 2008, but much more critically in Iraq, we see in early 2008 a charge of the Knights and essentially Maliki going into Basra because he thinks it's all going wrong and aiming to sort the place out. I think that was a bad time for the Brits, actually. And I think actually that because we had started to shift our main effort, shift our priorities from Iraq into Afghanistan, actually, I think actually we weren't able to actually respond, and we didn't really have the forces to respond as we perhaps might have done. I think that that decision to move from our priority from Iraq to Afghanistan, we will look back, I suspect, with some regret. I was intimately involved with it. The decision was based on a paper which was written at the top of the military in the Ministry of Defence. And in that paper, the arguments were made for a shift of main effort, or priority as we would say, from Iraq to Afghanistan. The interesting thing about that paper is that it was based, largely speaking, on a military argument. The military argument was that we were losing consent in Afghanistan, in Iraq. We still had consent in Afghanistan, and therefore the leverage that you would get from the same force would be greater in Afghanistan. However, there was a sentence put in that paper, I know because I put it in myself, which said that we should not do this without a broader foreign policy analysis of where Britain's interests lay. That sentence was removed, and I can tell you that we shifted from Iraq to Afghanistan with no broader foreign policy analysis. And I look back with some regret that I didn't push that sentence harder. It was intuitive at the moment, I'm bound to say, at the time. I was just looking to myself and saying, now, which of these two places is more important to us? Is it the Gulf, the oil, Basra, the jewel of the Gulf, or is it Afghanistan? And looking back, I think actually intuitively I was seeing it as Afghanistan, but I see it with more clarity now. Where did that take us to? I think it took us to where we are now, actually. Afghanistan playing out in a pretty much an unexpected way on the basis of what we did. Afghanistan playing out a rural, you know, in many ways it seemed right. It was a rural campaign, better suited for air power, for example, and perhaps less of an urban mire than Basra was, actually. But it certainly hasn't proved as much fun as we would like to think. I think that is my evidence, really, for this issue about strategic thinking. I think we could have thought those things through better, looking back. And I'll talk a bit about this and about what Burnham was doing in the Public Administration Select Committee. But as I look in Afghanistan, I saw a confused command structure. And I saw, as well, the Ministry of Defence, and indeed Whitehall in general, shifting its focus from a broad campaign across Afghanistan to one province, which was Helmand. And when you look at Helmand, it is one of 34 provinces in Afghanistan. And if you ask me where I thought it was in terms of the priority provinces, it wouldn't be in my top five. It's not an unimportant province, but it's quite obvious to anybody who knows the campaign that the two key provinces in Afghanistan are Kabul and Kandahar. And I don't really think that we had worth thinking at that stage, and we were starting to come down and away from the strategic. I remember going down to... I was invited to come down and look at Helmand, and I said, I don't want to go. We've got 5,500 troops by this stage in Helmand. I assume that we must know what's going on there. So instead of that, we got around the campaign. I and a very bright diplomat, and we went to the west in Herat, and we went to the east in Bagram, to the north, and really tried to get a proper sense of what was going on. What was interesting was that when we're talking, I remember talking very well to the J5, is what I would call them, but the planners in Herat and the planners in Bagram, so there's American planners in Bagram, and Spanish and Italian planners in Herat, and asking them the same question. These are military planners in those two headquarters. What strategy are you using to drive the campaign? And the answer I got, and I had to press them for it, the answer I got was pretty much the same in both, which was there's none, sir. There's no strategy we're using to drive this campaign. We're just doing our best in what we think is best. And I think actually this is key to understanding why we in the West have not done as well as we think we should have done. To me, and I've written about this subsequently, to me actually what was lacking was a strategy which combined three key pillars: the government of Afghanistan, shared with NATO and shared with the United Nations Assistance Mission to Afghanistan, UNAMA. And if we had had a strategy which had been shared between those organisations, I think we might have had a better chance of success. Doesn't mean to say we won't necessarily be successful, but I think with a shared strategy, we'd have been better off earlier. There never was that. I think the first time that we've seen it is with General Petraeus arriving. And we now have, I think, a very simple strategy based on a very simple idea, which is the American doctrinal idea of clear, hold, clear, hold, build. Clear out the insurgents, hold on to the area, prevent them coming back in, and then build in those other bits and pieces, actually. It's a simple idea, but it worked for the Americans in Iraq. They came out of Iraq with a score draw, or slightly better, and there's a possibility still, in my view, of it working in Afghanistan. Let me now, though, turn to the UK. So that's my evidence for saying that, we aren't as good at strategic thinking as we can. Let's now look at Britain, and to a certain extent, perhaps the West to a slightly lesser extent, and talk about what our objectives are and the context in which we find ourselves on this campaign. I think it would be fair to say that what people don't always realise is that actually Britain has very little control over this campaign. It's simply a question of mathematics and geography. At the moment, there are US Marines are the predominant forces in Helmand, and we are in one-third of one of 34 provinces. We've got a force of about 9,500. I haven't got the exact numbers, but when you look at the overall statistics, it's about, of the NATO force, it's around about 8% of the force. Of the overall Afghanistan and NATO force put together, it's about 4% of the force. And as the Afghan numbers build up, it will come down to about 2% of the force. Now, of course, it's a well-found 2% of the force, but it is in one-third of one of 34 provinces. So don't let's for a moment think that Britain has much control, if any, over this campaign. What are our objectives? At the moment, I've looked on and checked the MOD's website yet again, and you will see the key objective, as far as the MOD are concerned, is preventing Afghanistan becoming a haven for international terrorism. I think there's something in that objective. It's an international community's objective, but if you ask me what I thought Britain's objectives would be, I would say they would be different. I think there is a debate to be had about whether actually this is helping our security or not. And I call for evidence on that from Eliza Manning Buller, who, when she was talking to the Iraq inquiry, said that actually the events abroad since 2001 have made their problem, MI5's problem in this country, worse rather than better. So I think it's fair to say that there is an interesting and nuanced debate about whether our activities abroad in places like Afghanistan and Iraq are in our overall security interests. However, I do think they're in our foreign policy interests. I think there is a fairly strong argument for us to be in Afghanistan. The question is at what level and what scale and how much we're prepared to pay. What would I say are our objectives there? I think our objectives are pretty much around three things. I think firstly is to be a good ally to the Americans and to NATO. So to stick with the mission, especially given that we pulled out from under the Americans in Iraq. I think we're best to stick with this mission and see it through with the Americans and with NATO. I think there's a UK bilateral issue, which is that if the Pakistanis are facing an insurgency south of the Durand Line, then I think there is something to be said for us to be there in the north contributing politically, if not militarily, and politically by having troops on the ground. I think the third objective is that we were in that country, and I think we have a certain responsibility still to the Afghan people to do what we can to help them out of this situation in which they find themselves. The question is, how much should we be prepared to pay for those objectives? And I think at the moment the price is high. The price that we paid at the moment is that we're fixed militarily in Afghanistan and we're struggling to do things around the world elsewhere. We've got a force structure, which I heard Professor Michael Clark talk about recently and describe as perverse. And it's a force structure which seems to me an armed forces structure which is based around the idea of more Afghanistans. And yet I don't see huge amounts of political appetite for it. So to me, I would want to reduce the size of my force there. And I want to reduce it and decide what I could sustainably keep out there without knocking out the rest of my armed forces structure. At the moment, for example, I've taken Nimrods out of the force structure, or we've taken Nimrods out of the force structure. I can't see how we can patrol without Nimrods, UK's exclusive economic zone on our own territorial waters. And that's just one example of other bits and pieces. So I want to be in a position where actually the force structure that I got, I could do Afghanistan, but without actually perversely skewing the force structure away from key issues for Britain's security. What would that mean? I mean, I think it means that we need a large land component out there still to be seen as part of it. Special forces make a huge difference, and the Americans really appreciate our special forces. Our staff officers do well out there. But there are other bits and pieces which we could take out. We could take out the Tornado Force tomorrow. Would make not the slightest bit of difference to the Americans. They're not really that fussed about it. We could take about other bits and pieces out. And we could put other things in. What the Americans would really appreciate is help with police training. Police training is critical to this campaign. And we have in the police service of Northern Ireland a very unique resource, which are people who are trained in counterinsurgency operations, experienced, and they're probably the only police in the West who has this unusual resource. So a few police would make a huge difference to the Americans. And for 1,000 police, military, we could probably cover almost all the Pashtun areas and actually help in that critical area. But the key issue, I think, I'm saying, is that it's about price. I think this is a thing that's worth doing, but the price at the moment that we're paying in Afghanistan is too high, given its importance, which is not critical to Britain's security. I think, actually, I'm close now to wrapping up. You'll be pleased to hear about it. This evidence, to me, is evidence, and this is where I want to sort of really come in at the end, actually, is evidence of a lack of capacity to think strategically. I started to think about this about 5 years ago. I was on a visiting fellowship at Oxford, and was starting to think, and I had this intuitive sense that we weren't very good at making strategy. But the more I've come on, and the more I've worked on it, the more I've come to see it, I think I'm right, and I think that others are right too. Bernard called me as a witness to the Public Administration Select Committee, and there are a number of academics who I listen to, and I thoroughly recommend, I hope you won't mind me saying this, Bernard, but I thoroughly recommend the Public Administration Select Committee's report. What it essentially says is that this country has lost its capacity to think and act strategically. The evidence for me is in the 10 years that we've watched. I quote in my book a very well-known, in my circles, French general called André Beaufré, who wrote in 1963, and said that in war, the loser deserves to lose because his failures will be due to failures in thinking, either before or during the campaign. And although there have been tactical issues going on the ground in Helmand, and although there have been tactical issues going on the ground in Basra, I think that our key problems in this country, in both Iraq and Afghanistan, have been due to failures in thinking, either before or during the campaign. Bernard, I think I've probably said enough, actually. It looks like we haven't got Anatole with us to join.
Well, I think you said all that needs to be said. I think we should go straight on to questions.
Yes.
I suppose all I would say in Anatole's absence, first of all, he's the author of an excellent book called Ethical Realism, exact title of the book, about he wrote a book about American foreign policy. There it is. Ethical Realism, a vision for America's role in the world to counteract neocon sentiment, and very much what a traditional British interests-based foreign policy would look like, and promulgated that as it should be an American construct as much as a British one. I think he would share many of the concerns about over-ambition and over-idealization about American foreign policy. And I would add, in Afghanistan, I think we are still gripped by a lack of how this will end, a lack of a grasp of how we will bring this to a conclusion in Afghanistan. And both President Obama and Prime Minister Cameron have been drawn into setting end dates without being able to define a political end state. And it's very notable that I've met General Petraeus on both met him in Baghdad, and I met him in London more recently now that he's commanding in Afghanistan. And it was very noticeable that in Baghdad, he had a completely global view of the campaign from the political right down to the tactical. And one senses that that kind of grasp is completely lacking in Afghanistan. That if there was to be an end game in Afghanistan, it would revolve around the 80 to 150 people who are really the decision makers in Afghan tribal society. It would involve them all coming together to agree to take back control of their own country. It wouldn't be the Bonn settlement. It would have to involve the majority tribe, the Pashtuns, who were largely excluded from the Bonn settlement after the invasion of Afghanistan. And that would involve incorporating into those discussions quite a number of people who call themselves Taliban, or we call Taliban, but who are only associated with Taliban because Taliban and even Al-Qaeda have aligned themselves with the interests of the Pashtun belt, who want to expel the foreign soldiers, the Ferengi, from their country. It would have to involve, such a settlement would have to involve the powers around Afghanistan. Iran, China, Pakistan, India, and Russia, principally. There would need to be a mutual agreement, and possibly involving Saudi Arabia as well. There would need to be mutual agreement on the basis of which the international community is going to play in Afghanistan. And it would need to stabilise the relationship between India and Pakistan. Because at the moment, Pakistan regards Afghanistan as its hinterland, as where it would retreat and fight from in the event of a war with India. And India regards, therefore, Pakistan's relationship with Afghanistan as potentially a threat to its interests. So it's in India's interests to destabilize any relationship between Pakistan and Afghanistan. And there has to be an agreement, which cross-fertilizes into the Kashmir conflict, but there has to be an agreement between Pakistan and India on how to relate to Afghanistan, and that would have to be brokered by the United States. And I would submit that the United States would have to guarantee Pakistan's security in relation to any hostility from India in order to persuade Pakistan to lay off the very traditional and long-standing relationship between ISI and Taliban across the border, across that no-man's land that we call the Hindu Kush. It would be a complicated chess game, but at the moment there is absolutely no sense that anyone is even thinking of bringing together these kinds of discussions. And I can only guess that we're betting the ranch on a huge amount of military training to somehow that the rather illegitimate regime in Kabul can be sustained by its own security forces with less and less Western support. I would submit that that is going to be an inherently unstable situation, and that it's quite likely that the Afghan armed forces will fall to pieces as quickly as we leave. So I'm not very optimistic. I think we should be thinking afresh. I think I fear that we're fixated on where does our national interest lie in this question? I think our national interest lies in two places. One is we have a very strong relationship with India and Pakistan, and I think we should be thinking about how we're going to preserve those relationships as we remove ourselves from this theatre. And the other, of course, is that we should not walk out on our American allies. And I think that maybe is the main preoccupation of our present government. So long as we leave together with the Americans and share their fate in Afghanistan, we will be all right. I wish we did far more bilaterally with Pakistan. If we put in 10% of the effort into military training and military diplomacy into Pakistan, as we are in Afghanistan, I think we would reap much, much greater dividends for our country. And indeed, it is the Pakistan relationship with terrorism which is our primary security concern, rather than Afghanistan. Personally, I don't think the Afghans will ever have al-Qaeda back into their country. I think they've learnt their lesson. They resented their presence when they had them there, and I think Stephen's absolutely right when he says the only reason they would not abandon them at the time of the invasion of Afghanistan was purely because of the Pushtun code of Pushtun Wali. And our failure to recognise that, and our failure to recognise the ascendancy of the Pushtun tribe in Afghan politics, was a major strategic failure. We've cemented in that instability in the Kabul regime. At the moment, we back the Northern Alliance to the exclusion of the majority Pashtun in Afghanistan. And I think unless we address that, we're not going to reach a political settlement in Afghanistan. But there's my rather gloomy prognosis. Let's have some questions and ask Stephen some questions.